The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, one of the things that I know you watch on a pretty consistent basis is what is the psychology in the market based on volatility? Okay, they measure something called the VIX, which is volatility in the S&P 500 or the overall stock market.
Well, and you know, for us, I think the market is generally very optimistic or cautiously optimistic, I guess you could say, coming into a number of the things that we expect to be announced, whether it's the ECB or the Fed here in the next 2 to 3 weeks. How proactive are they going to be? So there is that sort of cautious optimism, but the bet's already been placed, and that's why we see the Dow at 13,000. They're hoping that they were right in terms of assuming the Fed's role in the marketplace. We would define ourselves as cautiously pessimistic.
Right.
It could be worse, but we certainly see room for deterioration and rapid deterioration if expectations don't go as according to plan.
Well, you know, Bill King, who we interviewed last week, he says that the stock market right now is in the most dangerous territory of the year because it's above 13,000. It's going up on bad news because they're waiting for, you know, a little bit more QE candy. And then it goes down on good economic news. So how is that sustainable?
Yeah. And your point on the volatility index is simply this, that it dipped to below 14. Mm-hmm. And that was mid-August, and now it's back above 18.
So 14 would show complacency.
It really would. Anytime you're below 15, you're at sort of record levels of complacency. So there's a few more people who aren't quite as sure of their bets over the last 2 weeks, but sort of mid-August, you looked at the most ridiculous levels in terms of complacency for the summer.
You know, to look at where that money comes from, David, to go into the equities market, the stock market, you know, we've had incredibly low rates, artificially low interest rates for years now. So a person really can't go out and just put money in the bank and earn any interest. It almost forces them, even old people who should not necessarily be speculating with their money, it forces people to take risks and go into that equity market. How long can those rates stay as low as they are?
Well, that was a question that was asked this last weekend. And, you know, we had our McIlvaney Wealth Management briefing here in Durango, the second of the year. It fell on the same day as the Jackson Hole meeting. So we had our own views of what needed to be done. And one of the questions was, how long can rates be held at these levels?
Right.
You know, and there's really two ways of looking at it. Number one, we're looking at an artificially low rate. So arguably, the activities of the Fed in the marketplace creating those artificially low rates could go on for a long time.
As long as they can maintain control. I mean, David, Treasury bills have returned negative rates in related to inflation for years now.
Right. Now, the second element of that, so number two, is the market can sort of reassert itself and supersede any activity that the Fed has in the marketplace. So those two things are the real challenge, anticipating which is in control. If you look at the TIPS, which is the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, you now have negative returns on 1 year paper, 2 year paper, 5 year paper, all the way out to 15 year paper.
So people are willing to give up buying power in the future just to have what? The safety of treasuries?
Well,
is that it?
TIPS are an indication. It's a place where people would take money if they're concerned about inflation. They're assuming that the CPI is going to move higher with inflation, of course, and they're going to be compensated. TIPS are structured in such a way that you're compensated commensurately to an adjustment higher with the CPI.
Okay.
Of course, we have our own argumentation as to how legitimate CPI is, because it is sort of massaged, if you will, with components coming in and going out, which are fairly relevant to real-world inflation. That's another issue. What we see there is that people are really saying we don't anticipate any inflation, and everyone the world over is betting on deflation. Everyone the world over is betting on some sort of a collapse in the financial system. And here's what's interesting. When everyone is betting one direction, you can usually bet that everyone is wrong.
Right.
And it's usually, and again, it's not, you don't want to be an iconoclast just for the sake of being an iconoclast, or a contrarian just to be cantankerous and against the trend. We're not artists trying to prove our identity as something other than the norm, okay? But the point is, when you have this many people betting in the treasury market that some sort of demise is occurring, they're either dead right or they're dead wrong.
Well, and can't you figure, though, that the Chinese contraction and Euroland, the contraction over there or the danger over there, is forcing people to the only thing they can actually own in paper that they feel safety with. Wouldn't you say that's a big part of the purchasing of treasuries right now?
Sure, sure. And as you see that sort of panic capital into the treasury market, rates have gotten squeezed to record low levels. What's interesting is, again, over the last sort of 2, 3, 4 weeks, we've seen some easing up there, and rates have been rising not only in the treasury market, but in the German Bund market, and even in the sterling market, the 10-year British paper as well.
Well, and aren't the central bankers right now playing things awfully dangerous as well? I think they're assuming that they know just how long they can control rates and continue to print money. I mean, inflation is always the danger, David. All throughout history, these are the beginning signs of inflation. Low interest rates, the printing of money, and the thought that there's going to be deflation. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, but deflation almost always precedes a hyperinflation.
Yeah, and we'll talk about sort of faith and the faith that in the investment community has in central bank activity in a few minutes, but I think one of the things that you have to take stock of here is that the central bankers who are being entrusted with taking away monetary stimulus and loose monetary policy at just the right time so that there is no inflationary consequences to their loose monetary policies, these are the same central bankers who did not see a problem emerging 2000, 2001, 2002, or following 2005, 6, and 7. That period of recovery following the stimulus just 3, 4, 5 years earlier than that, they didn't see a problem coming into 2007 and 8. And so again, they didn't see the problem, but they now have the solution. And we're assuming that these folks who have a hard time anticipating the future and are largely involved in a rear view mirror policy making measure type of formulation.
Right.
Are going to anticipate. It's a disconnect for investors because they are largely looking in the rearview mirror, and yet we are assuming they're looking way out on the horizon and are going to be able to anticipate and pull back these loose monetary policies.
But in this case, the sort of Damocles that they're standing directly under and they assume they can dodge just in time, it's gotten to be so gigantic that if it did fall and they didn't dodge in time, it's devastating.
Right. Well, and certainly we still have the fears of a European collapse. We have the easing of those said fears, which I think would go a long way towards reversing the flows of capital into the U.S. Treasury market.
Mm-hmm.
It takes rates much higher as demand diminishes. And the challenge with analyzing yields is that new data, surprises, frankly, of any kind, can radically and very quickly reverse the present course.
That's that sword that's falling.
Yeah, exactly.
Any new data.
Yeah, so you're in this strange position of seeing 1 to 1.25% in the U.S. 10-year as a high likelihood given a collapse in the Eurozone. On the other hand, we're already at suppressed and artificially low rates. Arguably, any news data that has a return to normalcy in the U.S. economy, we can see those 10-year yields reverse course and move the opposite direction very quickly.
Which, you know, David, we talk about the negative effects of these, you know, artificial low interest rates. We've talked about the retirees having to take and risk money that normally they would have earned interest on. You know, they would have been able to just put it into the bank, put it into treasuries, earn the interest, and maybe, you know, enhance their Social Security checks. But low rates do benefit some, and I think it's worth pointing out, you know, for every crisis, there's an opportunity. For every negative, there can be a positive to those who are adept and understand what's going on. Can you explain some of the advantages of artificially low rates for the individual investor?
Yeah, well, and this is the confusing part, because on the one hand, we're saying that low rates, which generally are an indication of low risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're just looking at where you're going in your yield hunt.
Low risk of default, yeah.
Exactly. And actually it indicates nothing of the sort when they're artificially constructed.
Mm-hmm.
But there's people who are opportunistically taking advantage of that. Namely, you've got big companies. You know, earnings are improving as you see both stock buybacks and refinancing at record levels. We'll talk about August in just a minute. So big companies are taking advantage of refinancing debt at these low levels. And then you've got holders of large mortgages. This
sure.
is, you know, households. And I say holders of large mortgages because, generally speaking, the folks who are refinancing at this juncture have plenty of equity to give up. So if you bought in an inopportune moment, 2004, 5, and 6, you're likely negative in your equity, and
right.
you can't refinance. So you may be stuck at a 5, 6% mortgage rate without any ability, unless you're willing to write a check for $50,000 or $100,000 just for the privilege of refinancing.
But for someone who's owned more than a decade, who purchased back before all that happened, they could actually refinance sub 4% right now.
Exactly, exactly. So, and that's what we're seeing. The third area, so you've got big governments, you've got holders of large mortgages, and the last area that's benefiting from this low rate environment, which we've talked about before, of course, is government. And that is very clear. So, you know, when you look at the corporate landscape, there's about 100 cash-rich companies which are doing their, not only are their earnings improving, and they're building this war chest, so to say,
right,
but they're also refinancing aggressively. They stand in stark contrast to small and medium-sized business, which still have very little access to credit.
Right.
So again, I mean, what's the difference? If you're running a company and you've got 100 to 500 employees, maybe even 1,000 or 2,000 employees, you're still a small to medium enterprise, and your access to credit through the banking system is very, very difficult. Meanwhile, you take somebody like an Illinois Tool Works. This last week, I mean, this is just one example, 30-year paper with a coupon of 3.9%. That was $1.1 billion in borrowing just for ITW.
Hmm.
And again, August was a classic case in point. If you're looking at corporate credit expansion the world over, it was close to $250 billion in 1 month, the largest August on record. So corporations are taking advantage of these low rates, and it is giving a short-term boost to earnings.
Well, and you know, that brings up another point, because we get the question all the time, what can the Fed do? Well, the Federal Reserve has kept rates low, and you talked about some of the people who've benefited from that. It's actually not the little guy necessarily that has benefited from the low rates. But quantitative easing, that's the second thing the Fed can do. They can print money. They can monetize the debt. They can do those types of things. Here's my question, though. Okay, why after two rounds of quantitative easing, with little to no economic growth filtering down to the little guy, why would we see this QE3 as a valid course of action?
Yeah, well, and frankly, there's no improvement in employment. Frankly, so QE1, QE2.
And unemployment kept getting higher and higher.
Right. So there was a temporary reprieve, really, in the equity market. In the financial centers, there was reprieve because of QE1 and QE2. And that, I think, is where we should consider the costs in terms of both dollar volatility and increased interest rates in light of QE3.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, only the balance sheet neutral operation twist was of benefit to the Treasury market, lowering borrowing costs, allowing the dollar to creep marginally higher.
Right.
What assets might they purchase in sort of a QE3? I mean, we keep on talking about QE3, but they're going to have to get creative, because the out of the box, if they did exactly what they did with quantitative easing 1 or quantitative easing 2,
mm-hmm.
again, there's a net benefit to the stock market on a very temporary basis. Beyond that, what was the benefit? And again, to the employment numbers, no benefit. To the overall economy, you know, it was interesting because Ben this last week went so far as to say, we can't really prove where there's been an economic benefit, but our models do show improvement.
Well, yeah, so we have computer models up here in New York that we run, and it's, you know what, forget the facts, forget actually that unemployment rose and then it never filtered back down. We do have a couple of algorithms in a computer program that says, hey, it's working for us in some sort of virtual paradise.
We mentioned this years ago, but do you remember the Wizard of Oz, what his former occupation was before he was pulling the strings and all the levers and cords behind the screen and making Oz this brilliant and beautiful magical place?
You mean he wasn't really the wizard?
No, he worked at a county fair,
right,
and he was a hot air balloon man. He was a hot air balloon man. Lest we never forget, the men who were behind the screen pulling the levers with their beautiful models that show economic...
Yes.
Exactly. Who are they really?
Yeah.
What are they before they were the Wizards of Oz? Hot air men.
Most of them got published, though, by academic institutions, Dave. You need to understand, they have been published.
That's true. Credentialing is everything.
All right, now I've got a question for you. Okay. Is the banking system, who did benefit from quantitative easing and low interest rates, and the U.S. Treasury, are they now dependent, like a drug addict, on low rates? I mean, what happens to them if rates rise?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, we've got to ask the question, if they did go towards QE3, and I mean, why?
Right.
Towards what end? I mean, because there was no palpable benefit to the man in the middle class, if you will. Is there a large institution that's quietly bleeding, necessitating sort of the vigilant stance of the Fed? Is the banking system and the U.S. Treasury, as you say, dependent now on lower rates? And if so, you know, an improvement in economic statistics like we had last week in the Beige Book,
right,
frankly, is awkward, if only because the conditions for low rates are being held constant artificially by bond purchases from the Fed. Now, again, if the economy is improving, then the case for artificial manipulation of the yield curve weakens, and the likelihood of higher rates set by market forces comes into focus.
David, it's almost like they're disappointed when things start getting better. You know, it reminds me of a person who goes through a surgery, and they're given Vicodin or morphine or what have you, and it starts to become worse and worse news the more they get better, because they're going to have to back their drug away, and they'd rather have the Vicodin than actually have the outcome that they came in for in the first place.
So perhaps Ben needs things to remain on edge, not in crisis mode, just on the edge, to facilitate what has been happening now for several years, the redistribution of income from the household sector to big banks, number one, and government, number two, via subsidized borrowing costs. I mean, we like to think that someone's looking for resolution and wants to see an improvement in the economy, but at what cost? The right. game that's being played now, the Treasury has to have low rates in order to finance themselves. If rates begin to rise, the Obama administration last year suggested that we could see a doubling of interest costs by 2015.
Right.
Well, that's a bit of an awkward moment, because we can't afford $500 to $600 billion in interest costs.
On between $2 and $2.5 trillion of tax revenue. That's what we bring in.
Yeah, well, it's so that $500 billion moving up from less than $200 billion in terms of the interest component on our national debt, they can't afford the rise in interest costs. So,
right.
you know, there is this awkward juxtaposition, the battle between the Beige Book and Ben Bernanke, where Bernanke does want to see an improvement in the economy on the one hand, but on the other hand, he knows what the cost will be to the U.S. Treasury and to the Ponzi scheme that's being played in the context of rebuilding bank balance sheets. Are we done yet? Is there stability in the banking system yet that would justify a move towards a more conservative monetary policy?
Well, and David, this economic weakness, you know, I want to make sure that we're not too myopic here. And, you know, this show, you travel to Asia, you travel to Europe. This economic weakness is widespread. I mean, this decoupling that has been preached by some of the pundits out there, where, you know, emerging countries or China or Europe, they're all disconnected now and they can do their own thing. I mean, if interest rates rise, or if we continue the economic slowdown, they get taken down even further, do they not?
Oh, well, sure. And you know, if you're looking at the contribution of global growth, and growth in global GDP, it was the emerging markets, the BRICS, and those types of countries that over the last 10 years have contributed most. Roughly a third of the growth component in GDP is coming from the BRICS. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, those sorts of countries.
Right.
With the U.S. coming in at close to 16% and Europe coming in closer to 6%. So that's where the growth trend has come from. Now the question is that ultimately sustainable? And what we're seeing is that developing countries have not decoupled from the West. They merely follow the engine around the bend on a delayed basis.
So they're following the engine, but the engine right now is running just purely on faith in central bankers. David, that's why we're talking about when economic news is bad, the stock market goes up, because they're thinking, hey,
now the ECB will act. Now the PBOC will act.
Well, how much faith is sufficient? Because we're talking not just the United States, but if we're the engine and the caboose, or the other cars of the train, or everyone else, it's all attached to faith on Ben Bernanke, basically.
Yeah, and yeah, again, in this case, we're talking about faith of investors in the capacity of central banks and bankers around the world to stimulate growth and stir recovery.
Right.
You've got Germany, you've got Japan, Brazil, China. They are all slowing or with anemic growth. Brazil and other Latin American countries are now being hit by the slowing demand for commodities from China. Does this come as a surprise? No, not really. I think we've been addressing this, but the issue is it's global in nature. The developing countries and the developed world are both experiencing the malaise. Japanese exports to the EU.
I saw that in The Economist, down 25%.
In total value from last year at the end of June to this year. So, you know, you've got weak Chinese PMI numbers out last week. 49.2 versus the 50 expected. Well, guess what? This is good news. Because
they're going to intervene, just
exactly,
like Ben Bernanke does here.
Exactly. Yeah. Bad news is good news. The media spins it and says, yes, the PBOC is close to intervention. Is the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, talking about intervention? Have they laid out a strategy? No, it's just implied worse is better. Not in sort of the Lenin sense,
right.
But the worse things get, the more likely we are to see central bank intervention. That's really not the definition definition of a healthy economy or a healthy market, which I think goes full circle to why we talked with Bill King last week, and he said this is a very dangerous period for equity market investors because this is not a reality built on facts. This is not a market that reflects current economic reality.
Well, and I think we should point out, and Bill King definitely pointed it out last week, not everyone out there is completely ignorant to this fact, okay, that things are broken, they're not getting better. Everyone's assuming someone's got a wild card they can put on the table that's going to just cure things, but nobody really knows what it is, so they keep playing the game, hoping that they have the wild card.
Well, and then that's it, because not everyone has one. But everyone's pretending as if they do. You get the ECB September 6th meeting with Draghi, and obviously it's important. It was important enough for him to skip the Jackson Hole meeting. He did not come over because he was preparing for this meeting. So, you know, what can we expect? And again, this is what everyone's anticipating. We've got the equity markets in Europe, which are, you know, 20-25% higher off of their lows. And we're talking about 90-95% off of their peaks and now recovering off of rock bottom lows. Well, is that an indication of strength in the economy in Europe, or will the ECB offer to buy unlimited amounts of paper under that three-year threshold?
Are you betting that they're going to have to come out with something a little like Ben Bernanke hinted at for the United States?
You know, the ECB may surprise. They may exceed expectations. Draghi is moving closer to that blend of monetary and fiscal policy, and it's sort of a subtle coup. It's a coup of sorts in the sense that the ECB is moving in to fund specific government needs via bond purchases. No, fiscal policies and those responsibilities are not being relinquished by various governments.
Well, not officially.
Right. But no one's arguing about the free lunch via the ECB. So as long as it's constitutionally appropriate, which of course when you're looking at any document, hermeneutics is very important. What are you reading? What are you gleaning from the document? How do you interpret it? That's what's being twisted and manipulated sufficiently that, you know, the contortionists, this legal contortionism is happening in Europe today so they can read the Constitution such that the ECB now has the freedom that they didn't have 2 years ago to do the very same thing.
Well, and you know, it reminds me of our interview with Ottmar Issing, who was one of the founders of the ECB. In fact, he served with them for 7 years. Okay. He knew that there were crises coming with, you know, Spain and Portugal and Italy. And he understood that a monetary policy, all countries have monetary policies and fiscal policies. The monetary policy is how you control the money. The fiscal is how you control the taxation and the spending. Okay. And there was a definite separation when the euro and when the ECB was accepted that these countries would keep their own fiscal decisions. And what you're talking about at this point is the ECB is creeping into that without officially being granted that, because they have to. Otherwise, this thing falls apart. No monetary union in history has ever succeeded without having some sort of fiscal unification as well.
And one of the major leaps forward is through the banking system. So following the June meeting, the Euroland is really moving full steam towards the ECB being in a control position over all Euroland banks. There's about 6,000 banks. And while they can't get to fiscal union to date, bank instability is serving as justification for the ECB to creep into an ultimate oversight position superseding your national central banks. And, and of course, they may hand off and delegate certain banks to the national level, but they're in that ultimate oversight position. They're moving towards a position where, frankly, whether we like it or not, if you have the sort of the grand socialist dream of Europe or not, it doesn't matter. If they can resolve the crisis, you're going to see some radical shifts, one of which we were just talking about in the treasury market, where the panic buying into treasuries on the assumption that you're going to see an implosion of the eurozone and everything euro-ish, that concern goes away, and the buying that pressed treasury yields so low and treasury prices so high becomes selling, with prices dropping and yields returning to more normalized levels at higher levels. It comes at a very inconvenient time because the U.S. Treasury, as we've pointed out many times, is in the process of needing to refinance the large stock of that $16 trillion in debt.
We need them to need us
over the next 4 years. So anything that we can do to keep rates lower helps us. And if Europe gets fixed, that actually doesn't help us. So there's this strange irony. We don't hope the best for our neighbors because that means tougher financing for us.
Isn't it amazing how we're hoping for more and more bad news, either for our neighbors or some people for our own economy, so that quantitative easing comes in? But, you know, we interviewed Bill King last week, and there is an option outside of the currencies. You know, you've got the euro, you've got the renminbi, you've got the dollar. There are places that you can hold liquidity. But actually, Bill King pointed out last week, he said, and this is a quote actually from something he wrote again today, he said, gold is the preferred vehicle when economies are receding globally and most central banks are in easy money or quantitative easing mode. And that's what we're talking about. We have receding economies, and we have the potential of a surprise out of Europe, which is going to be easing. We have a potential out of the FOMC of more easing, or quantitative easing 3. So gold is the preferred vehicle. And we've seen gold become fairly active, Dave, over the last week or two.
Sure, it's been creeping higher to about 1700. You've got support on the downside at 1650 and 1550 below that. And our view is that sort of after breaking out of a pennant formation, which, you know, an initial move higher is positive, but we would not be surprised by temporary retracement to the level it broke out from. 1650 is a pretty normal expectation if you want to see it maybe run to 17 and a quarter, 1750 retrace to 1650.
But then what would be the next target?
I mean, we're talking about very, very short term, over the next 2 to 4 weeks, this kind of gyration between 1750 and 1650.
On the way to?
I'd suggest year end 1950 to 2100.
Okay.
Followed by a consolidation, and then the next move, the next major move after 2100 being 2500.
So we could have a very interesting 2013 in the gold market.
Yeah, and maybe we stretch those dates to, you know, 2014. There's going to be an adjustment period to either a new president or the old president as the world kind of figures out what's next. I would say this, seeing 2,500 in the gold price is probably a 2014-15 event under a Romney presidency, and it could be mid-year 2013 if Obama's reelected.
Okay, all right. But, you know, we're not just looking at gold here. We like to look at ratios. You know, we've always said that if you can get 60, 50 or 60 ounces of silver for an ounce of gold, the silver's a good deal. And then if you can only get 30 ounces of silver for an ounce of gold, then silver maybe needs to be sold and rolled into gold. Now, we're seeing that ratio tighten. We were at about 58 to 1, 58 ounces of silver to 1 ounce of gold just a few weeks ago. And we've seen that come down to, what, 52, 53 at this point.
Right. And, you know, the ratio's next move is likely to 45 to 1. Again, dividing the price of gold by the price of silver. You know, that would be following gold strength. And we might even, as we get to the sort of the 2014 2015 time frame, break the recent lows on the ratio of 31 to 1.
Right, and that was last year.
And yeah. Going into the 20s would be the first time we'd seen that in decades. Quite exciting for the silver owner, and likely, very likely. You know, again, is it 1 year out? Is it 2 years out? But again, it does argue for a healthy silver position, but with the idea of, as you just mentioned, Kevin, going back to gold at a lower ratio. Which do you love more, gold or silver? Actually, it's more compelling basis on relative value. Where should you be or have an allocation, and when you should lighten up is really determined by the math, not by personal preference.
Well, and for those unfamiliar with these ratios, you just simply take the price of gold today and you divide it by the price of silver, and you see what that ratio is. And, you know, silver becomes very attractive in the 50s to 60s, and it becomes a little bit high relative to gold in the 20s or 30s. It's almost that simple, but actually, it's best to have professionals watching it with you.
Well, and we generally scale in and scale out at some critical levels, so always best to do that and consult with someone on that. So, you know, I think if there's actions to take, I would just suggest this. We're finishing up the summer months. September and November tend to be the strongest for the metals of any months out of the year. And I would just say that if anyone has been sitting the fence, you did miss the opportunity to buy at 1530, 1550, 1600. And I would suggest that anywhere between 1650 and 1700, you've got to get off the fence. Mm-hmm. Because what is ahead immediately, both in terms of the fiscal cliff this year and a transition to a new administration or the same administration trying to solve the same problems, many of which are simply baked into the cake. Doesn't matter which person it is at the helm. Someone will take the hit in 2013, 14, 15, and 16 as the economy rolls over and the finger is pointed at the person in the Oval Office. You did this to us. You didn't do anything to improve our lot. And I think really the unwind both of the stock market, the bond market, and the next major and final leg higher of gold is immediately in front of us. 2013 to 2016 being the largest moves higher for the precious metals. My question is, in terms of actions to take, have you done enough? Do you own enough ounces in light of where we're at and where we're going over the next several years?
Well, and David, I might point out that in the last 25 years of working in the precious metals industry, when you're in a bull market, you have these periods of consolidation that last a little more than a year. Okay, and we've had three. We've talked about this in the program. We are now finishing one of those periods of consolidation. It's one of the most difficult times, actually, to roust yourself out of a slumber because it's been quiet. You know, we went to a little above 1900 and then settled back down and went sideways in the mid-1600s. And this is the time, each time there's a consolidation, to do something. Now, I know that's something that you pointed out. You had a private meeting with some of the people who use the wealth management platform, David. You finished out the week last week with some very special people. Our clients are amazingly special, and they flew in to meet with the management team. And what I'd like you to do is just share with the listeners, some of the people who are also on the platform who didn't get out here, what are some of the impressions that you had from the Thursday, Friday, early Saturday meetings?
You know, the challenge, I think, is for any investor in a period like this, the last 12 months particularly, to go through a consolidation where your primary trends are in place, but very unrewarding.
Right.
The challenge is just simply to remain patient. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you reanalyze and analyze over and over and over again the facts to make sure you are on the right side of the trend and to make sure that things haven't changed to your detriment, then the question becomes, if you're not immediately rewarded, can you sit tight?
Yeah.
Can you wait
if
for...
If you've done the right thing in the first place. We talked about this yesterday, David. You can either act or you can do nothing or you can do the right thing and then set it up and then be patient. But there's actually three actions here. There's action, there's doing nothing, and doing nothing isn't the right action. You know, if you haven't done what you needed to do ahead of time, patience doesn't reward anything. It's just doing nothing. But patience, after setting up the correct foundation, the correct management, and realizing that you're correct in the trend and you just wait for the next move, that's actually a very difficult action because you have to, like you said, you have to be patient. You have to watch without reward for a period of time.
Like I mentioned last week, I think the Bill King interview is one of the most important of the year. If for no other reason, the one point that he made, the market no longer reflects economic realities. As you're looking at the Dow and the S&P, 13,000, 1,400 roughly, that does not represent economic reality. So there are people investing in those markets today wholeheartedly believing that they do represent reality and that the Fed is there to support that reality. And what we've tried to point out earlier is this, when you're looking at the interest rate structure, when you're looking at the treasury market and the impact of the treasury market across all asset classes, including equities, what you have is something that is false. You have a false pretense set of the manipulated numbers put in motion by the Fed's activity in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. When you manipulate those rates lower, you're destroying price discovery and you're destroying what really prices mean, which is an indication of value across the board. Equities, you don't have real price discovery today. Bonds, you don't have real price discovery today. So again, it's important for an investor to step back and say, after looking at all of the true economic realities, why would we be tempted by something that is false? And what we're seeing is a massive influx of people who have been tempted and have fallen prey to that. We've seen over $1 trillion in the last year move into high-yield bond funds and the bond market via mutual funds, but specifically the bond market.
Well, David, you know, not just looking at reality, what we've tried to do with this show, I know you're very careful to look at the financial and then look at the economic and look at the political and then look at the geopolitical and continue that cycle. You know, next week, David, you're going to be talking to a man who's part of that bureaucratic society. You know, we can't discount the fact that these days the markets are being moved by Federal Reserve announcements, by things that the World Bank does, by things that the ECB does. We're talking about about command economy types of dynamics. So not only looking at the Austrian economic ups and downs and what the market's doing and what the market's saying, we also have to see what the establishment's saying and what their angle is. And we have Dr. Ocampo on next week.
Right. Tenured time with the United Nations in this last year nomination for the president of the World Bank. You know, what we're dealing with is on two fronts, false realities on the one hand, and excessive faith in the wrong things and maybe even the wrong structures and people on the other.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to unpack here is, who are these people? What are the ideas that are dominating the marketplace? Do we necessarily agree with them? No, but we better well understand what everyone else is putting their faith and confidence in, because when confidence fails and economic realities reassert themselves, there's going to be a handful of people with answers. And we hope those people are both our listeners and our clients.
Well, I'll be looking forward to that conversation next week. I know you will be too. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Or you can always give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.